Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe condemned North Korea's latest missile launch as absolutely intolerable. Mr. Abe spoke alongside President Trump at a hastily called news conference in a room at Mr. Trump's vacation home in the state of Florida. President Trump expressed his gratitude to the Prime Minister for his comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prime Minister. I just want everybody to understand and fully know that the United States of America stands behind Japan, its great ally, 100%. Thank you.
The North Korean missile launch, the first since Mr. Trump became president, took place early from an air base in a western province and flew eastwards to the Sea of Japan. United States immigration authorities have arrested hundreds of immigrants living in the U.S. illegally. It's happened in raids across the country, although authorities say the enforcement action was not linked to a recent executive order signed by President Trump to limit immigration. A spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security said the raids targeted criminal illegals, noting the arrests were part of a routine action. Afghan troops backed by American air support Sunday launched a major offensive against Islamic State or IS bases in the eastern Nangarhar province. A regional military spokesman told reporters in the provincial capital of Jalalabad that security forces have been tasked to clear Khat and other districts of IS militants before extending the action to other districts. Afghans refer to IS by its Arabic acronym Daesh. It said that both military and police forces have been involved. This is VOA News. International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde voiced optimism Sunday that U.S. President Donald Trump's planned tax cuts and construction spending would boost the American economy, but said they could cause trouble for the economies around the globe. Major U.S. stock indexes are near record highs, with the new U.S. leader promising to unveil a phenomenal tax cut plan in the next 2 to 3 weeks, while also pledging to launch $1 trillion in major infrastructure spending to fix the country's deteriorating roads and bridges and expand airports. Al-Shabaab militants overran two small military camps outside Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. In a dawn attack today, military sources estimate that about 40 to 50 government soldiers were stationed in each of the two camps. At least two soldiers were killed. Al-Shabaab claims its militia seized ammunition and two military vehicles. Iraqi Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr urged his supporters to suspend a demonstration near Baghdad's Green Zone after violent clashes left several dead and hundreds wounded. Iraqi security forces fired tear gas at al-Sadr supporters after reports they were trying to advance on the area where government institutions, including parliament and the prime minister's office, are located. Al-Sadr, who has strong ties to Iran's clerical establishment, held numerous protests outside the Green Zone last year, demanding the resignation of various government ministers and overrunning the Green Zone before withdrawing. Anti-abortion activists and supporters of a woman's right to choose staged demonstrations in dozens of U.S. cities Saturday, with the nonprofit group Planned Parenthood at the center of that discussion. Anti-abortion activists organized rallies in more than 200 locations Saturday. They're calling for the federal government to stop providing funds to Planned Parenthood because it provides abortions. It is something President Trump has said he wants to do. Meanwhile, pro-choice activists organized in many of the same locations to express support for Planned Parenthood. More than 70,000 Greeks evacuated their homes in the country's second biggest city Sunday to allow experts to defuse a World War II bomb. That bomb contained about 250 kilograms of explosives and was discovered 5 meters below ground during excavation work at a gas station last week. Police went house to house ringing bells and knocking on doors to remind people living within a 2-kilometer radius to leave their homes. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We want a peaceful resolution to the problem of South Sudan. It's no bigger problem into this. It's an issue of misunderstanding between brothers, and they should sit down and amicably resolve this problem.
The United Nations condemns ongoing fighting in South Sudan.
We are appearing for one of our colleagues, Barrister Mbala Agbo, one of the presidents of a teacher syndicate, and Mancho, who is an activist.
The trial of English-speaking Cameroonian activist in a military court begins on Monday.
She says Greenpeace revealed these two illegal awards and asked for a clarification from the government.
And the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo cancels two illegal logging licenses. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The United Nations Security Council has sharply condemned ongoing fighting in the South Sudanese regions of Upper Nile and Equatoria. It also warned that attacks on unarmed civilians could renew calls for sanctions. The warning followed reports of targeted killings of civilians, which it says constitute war crimes, according to the United Nations. For the latest development, I reached Madame Rebecca Nyadeng de Mabio, former South Sudanese Transport Minister and widow of General Dr. John Garang, the founding father of South Sudan.
We have for a long time pronounced the war in South Sudan as senseless. You are fighting against who? And who's fighting against who? It's the same people of South Sudan, and the people who are fighting with them are the liberators. Those who liberated them are the ones fighting them. So we are against what is going on in the country now. And we want a peaceful resolution to the problem of South Sudan. It's no bigger problem into this. It's an issue of misunderstanding between brothers. And they should sit down and amicably resolve this problem.
Madam Nyadeng, what is the current humanitarian situation in the country?
The humanitarian situation is very bad. And it's something that beyond description, you know, in South Sudan. But, you know, because the media and the region and the international community has gone quiet about the situation in South Sudan. What I hear in the news is Syria, Aleppo, and all other places. But the situation of South Sudan is very alarming. And you see those who are in Juba and in the big cities in UN camps. The situation is very bad. You go to displaced people's camp, you go to refugees' camp, and South Sudan now has the biggest refugees in the world. The humanitarian situation is very bad.
What is the status of the peace agreement? Since Taban Dengai joined President Salva Kiir, the two have repeatedly said they are implementing the agreement signed between President Kiir and former First Vice President Dr. Riek Machar.
For me, what the Taban and President Salva are implementing are not the agreement. What President Salva is implementing now with Taban, these are his own reservations. Because if you remember, President Salva signed the agreement reluctantly. He signed the agreement 8 days after. He brought up the reservation, about 20 reservations. These are the things being implemented now, not the agreement, because the signatory to agreement are not the people who are there. Dr. Riek is out, President Salva is there, but the status quo is being cut. So even Taban is doing nothing. Because if you ask Taban now as we speak, he will tell you that he's frustrated. If you ask the government says they're frustrated. And who is helping the people of South Sudan? So Taban and President Salva are not implementing the agreement. There's no agreement at all.
Madam Nyadeng, some European countries, including Britain, are organizing fresh peace talks in Doha, and they want Dr. Riek Machar to be part of the talks, and that IGAD should be an observer rather than a mediator, a role that it has played for some time now. What is the essence of having Dr. Riek Machar there? His presence alone, do you think, can lead to a final peace agreement to be implemented that could resolve the problems or the conflict in South Sudan?
If the international community is thinking of having a fresh agreement, then it will not be one-sided peace talk. Both of them have to be on the table. But I don't see what will they deliver. Because if they go for a fresh peace talk, what will it deliver? Because we have an agreement which is there. We have Addis agreement. We have Arusha agreement. They are there. These are the ones which we are supposed to rejuvenate and then bring those two people back. But if you say that you are going to talk to Riek and Salva is not there, you are doing nothing. If you are talking that Salva has to be there, like what they are doing with Taban now, war will not stop. So I don't know whether they will gain something in the new fresh talk in Doha. I don't know whether it will help, because for me, I take it as a waste of money, because tickets and whatever to take people there, I don't see, because it's better for this money to be given to those who are suffering in the refugee scam and displaced people scam. But let us rejuvenate the RCs, because if you wanted to bring Dr. Riek and President Salva back together, this is the solution that they have to do. But otherwise, I don't see that these two leaders are delivering anything.
Madam Rebecca Nyadeng de Mabior is a former South Sudanese transport minister and widow of General Dr. John Garang, the founding father of South Sudan. She spoke with me from here in the nation's capital. Meanwhile, as President Kiir renews his call for a national dialogue to look at the root causes of the country's conflict and to recommend solutions for peace, South Sudanese in Uganda saying the initiative represents a good step in the right direction, but say the president must not lead the dialogue. For VOA, Simon Peter Apiku has more from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
President Kiir announced the national dialogue will begin in early March and will be led by a committee he formed last December that includes politicians, religious leaders, civil society groups, and independent think tanks. Benny Gideon, a Uganda-based South Sudanese human rights lawyer, says if the dialogue is to be meaningful, it must include discussions on some of the most contentious issues in the country.
It is going to provide an independent platform for a honest conversation between the government and the citizen.
Pastor Joseph Simba of the Anglican clergy, who heads the South Sudanese International Christian Fellowship Church in Uganda, says the initiative is a good start, but just a start.
The national dialogue is good when people come together, accept themselves. They say, we are sorry, we apologize, and we want to country to go forward.
Reverend Simba says it has to be more than talk this time, adding the South Sudanese people have suffered for far too long.
My heart is broken. I've just been telling to our people in the church, my heart is just turned upside down when I just look to our people who are still suffering. Not in the camps, here in Uganda also, in Kenya, in Kakuma, in so many places I've been there. It's not good, I'm telling you.
Earlier, President Kiir said he would lead the dialogue, but Gideon says the president should not be in the driver's seat because it would send the wrong message.
When President Salva announced the national dialogue, I know in good faith, but unfortunately put himself as the convener. I mean, some of the issues that are going to be discussed in the national dialogue are issues connected to him as a president of the Republic, as a chairperson of the ruling party, as well as a commander-in-chief of the armed forces.
Francis Dabe, a former minister and member of parliament in the former Central Equatorial State and outspoken critic of the Kiir administration, says anyone other than the president should lead the dialogue.
In this scenario, you are the killer, the murderer of your own communities that have gone away into other countries. Here you want to be the one presiding, the peace agreement, the national dialogue. Now, how come? He is not supposed to be the person in charge of the national dialogue.
Gideon says many people believe that if the president remains at the helm, he would mobilize state instruments, including security operatives, to intimidate opponents and inhibit the free expression of ideas.
Majority opinion shows that they are not having a good faith in the ongoing national dialogue due to the fact that President Salva is the convener of the process and he is the accused. In one way or another.
With President Kiir still in charge, Dabe believes a national dialogue is meaningless.
You are initiating a dialogue with who? Your civilians are fleeing your country for refuge. In Uganda, we have more than 800 refugees flowing every day from South Sudan. Go to Kenya, go to everywhere. More than half of the population already has left in the country.
Reverend Simba says South Sudan's leaders must put the interests of the people first and end the suffering now.
We want to say to our people, this is our prayer. Let us just calm down. We stop the war. We stop the bloodshed.
Pastor Simba says the people want to see real peace, not more talk about peace. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Piku in Kampala.
The trial of activists of English-speaking Cameroonians who protested and criticized the government of alleged marginalization begins in the capital Yaounde Monday. They are scheduled to appear before a military tribunal where they face several charges, including committing acts of terrorism. So far, internet services to the English-speaking areas appear to have been cut after officials said activists have been using social media platforms to create tension by inciting the population against the administration. For more about the trial, I reach Evaristos Mofa, one of the lawyers representing the activists.
We are appearing for one of our colleagues, Barrister Mbala Agbo, one of the presidents of a teacher syndicate, and Mancho, who is an activist. They've brought many charges against them, ranging from propagation of false news, acts of terrorism, and so many. The charges that have been brought against them, most of them are felonies. Standing trial before the military tribunal here in Yaounde, even though they were arrested in regions far away from Yaounde. For Mancho, he was arrested in Bamenda, where there is a military tribunal. We can't explain why he was brought to Yaounde. Same goes with Agwombala, our colleague, who was arrested in Boya, as well as Dr. Fontem, who was arrested in Boya and brought to Yaounde.
Why are they being tried at a military court? They are not military officials, are they?
They are not military officials, but there is a special law that creates that military tribunal. It deals with offenders of armed crimes and acts of terrorism, be you a military person or a civilian. However, the principles of the Human Rights Commission of the African Charter on People's Rights says civilians ought not to be tried in the military tribunals. But in Cameroon, it so happens.
Some people are saying that it is right for them to be prosecuted in Yaounde because it is the seat of government, and this is a case between the state and offenders of the state who are causing agitation to undermine the country's peace and stability, which endangers the state from protecting its territorial integrity. So they should be dealt with in the capital, Yaounde, instead of the areas where they were apprehended.
I disagree with that, because in any criminal charge, it is the people of Cameroon against the accused person. If you commit an act of banditry in a region, it will be the people of Cameroon prosecuting you. I don't see the much difference with this, even though the military tribunal in Yaounde has territorial competence. It can move from Yaounde to Bamenda or to Boya to sit and hear those matters.
Are you therefore saying, perhaps, that the trial might not necessarily be fair? Because I spoke with the information minister who said that your clients were caught red-handed and that this trial is going to be free and fair and open to the public to ensure transparency and fairness. What do you say to that?
As to the fairness and so on, it is premature to say it. But from the way things are going, there are lawyers who have not been able to have access to the file to know exactly what is contained in that file. When will they have that access before tomorrow?
Have you been given access to the files of your client?
I personally have been given access. Others, I'm not alone in the file. We are about 68 at least. I'm not sure up to 5 lawyers have had access to that file.
In which language will this military trial be in? Will it be
English since these clients of yours were arrested in the English-speaking areas, of which they have been agitating against because they said they are being francophonized or being marginalized?
To the best of my knowledge, the language of the court is French. The criminal procedure code is very clear that any person apprehended should be judged where the crimes were committed or where they were arrested. Bringing them here is a violation of the criminal procedure code. And causing whatever thing will be said in court, the pleadings, to be translated is just unnecessarily prolonging the process, whereas they should have been tried in the court and in the language they understand.
Evaristos Morfa is one of the lawyers representing English-speaking Cameroonian activists. He spoke with me from Yaoundé. The government of the Democratic Republic of Congo says it is cancelling two illegal logging licenses following an investigation by the environmental action group Greenpeace. For VOA, William Klaus has the story from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa.
In September of last year, Robert Bapolo Mbongeza, the former environment minister, authorised two new logging concessions covering more than 4,000 square kilometres. That's according to a new investigation by Greenpeace. One permit went to an advisor of President Joseph Kabila, the other to a parliamentarian from the ruling party. VOA spoke to Irene Webiwa-Batoko, forest campaign manager at Greenpeace Africa. She says Greenpeace revealed these two illegal awards and asked for a clarification from the government. She noted that this is not the first time that Greenpeace has exposed an environment minister, taking illegal decisions that violate the moratorium on new logging concessions. The DRC introduced the moratorium back in 2002 in a bid to protect the world's second largest remaining rainforest. It is estimated that the livelihoods of 40 million people depend on it. The forest covers much of northern DRC as well as parts of five other countries in the Congo Basin. Atis Kabongo Kalonji was appointed environment minister in December as part of a government reshuffle in the DRC. He insists his ministry is remedying the situation. The minister told VOA that following Greenpeace's revelations about the illicit character of the logging titles granted by his predecessor, he can inform the Congolese public and the forestry operators that these licenses are now cancelled. He said he would soon sign a ministerial order confirming the cancellations, and he will put in place a mechanism to prevent future violations. Greenpeace says that judicial action, including sanctions against offenders, is necessary to stop recurring violations of the moratorium. Indeed, only a month before awarding these new licenses, the former environment minister, Bapolo, had cancelled three illegal titles which had been awarded by his predecessor in 2015 and uncovered by another Greenpeace investigation. Greenpeace is also urging donors to suspend a new $200 million programme to protect the rainforest, called the Central African Forest Initiative, until it can complete a comprehensive analysis of the activities it is funding. Webiwa says Greenpeace want to make sure that the money the donors have given and will give cannot strengthen the chaos that exists in the forestry sector. At the moment, she says, the necessary safeguards are not in place. The current environment minister, Kabongo, told VOA that DRC's international partners can rest assured that his ministry will not permit illegality. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Since South Africa became a democracy in 1994, the country has achieved success on sports fields globally. Its rugby team, the Springboks, has won two World Cups. Its soccer squad, Bafana Bafana, has won the Africa Cup of Nations and has competed in three World Cups. Soccer, rugby and cricket are indeed the most popular sports in South Africa. However, Statistics South Africa, a state organization that monitors trends in the country, says participation in fringe pursuits is spiking. For viewing,
Darren Taylor reports on one of these in the first part of a series on some of the country's latest sporting passions.
A sweating boxer punches a bag inside the top box gym in northern Johannesburg. On its walls are faded photos of boxing legends like Mike Tyson and local fight heroes including former lightweight world champ Dingaan Tobela. Ex-professional boxer Stephen Castle says when he opened Top Box 18 years ago, it was the only boxing fitness facility in South Africa. Now they're springing up across the country.
I think people are drawn to boxing because it's a cheap way of training that's effective. You don't need fancy equipment. You don't need this big leg press machines and these heavy weights and fancy treadmills and stepping machines.
One of his clients, body therapist Michelle Katsavas, says traditional workouts bore her and boxing's exciting.
It's great fun. You know, it's exercise, but it isn't. You don't really think about it at the time you're doing it. That's really why I do it.
Castle's training space is simple. A rudimentary boxing ring, skipping ropes, and a few punch bags. But as the brawny bald man says, a little goes a long way.
It increases your muscle tone. It makes you stronger where you're weaker. The routine is the routine. If you need to lose weight, you'll lose weight. Boxing will fix your body. It'll put it where it should be and correct it. That's what it does.
The trainer says unlike many other ways to get fit, boxing exercises the upper and lower body at the same time and bolsters the mind.
What I do give you is I give you the ability to believe in yourself, to have confidence in your own ability, and then the strength to know that you can defend yourself.
Katsava says her boxing skills make her feel less vulnerable on Johannesburg's mean streets.
It definitely helps in terms of how to punch correctly and to be aware of your stance, your positioning, and also your inner strength.
But she says misconceptions about fitness boxing abound, and when she tells people she boxes, they're usually surprised.
Well, they think it's a bit rough, which it isn't. They automatically think that you get in the ring and spar, and it's not like that at all. It's boxer size, so no, it's great.
50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 20, up. Okay, 1-2-1, let's go. 1-2-1, straight into it, quick.
Castle helps a boxer work out. He says those unfamiliar with boxing think it's nothing more than brutality. Tough men from poor backgrounds pounding one another. But Castle's clientele shatters this cliche.
One of our biggest membership bases has been women, not the tough, aggressive type of people. They recognize what boxing does for them in terms of fitness, in terms of strength, in terms of confidence. Boxing, I think, has become a sport for everybody.
Diverse people indeed visit his gym.
We've got a 62-year-old lady that's been coming here for years. Attorneys. One of the guys we just said hello to now was a CEO of a multi-million rand company. We've got all types. We've got students. We've got schoolboys.
The Filipino crowd chanting for Pacquiao.
TV footage of great contests of the past inspires Zimbabwean pro boxer Shepherd Musiiwa. He's one of Castle's trainers.
Most of my clients which I train are businessmen. They come here, they train like early in the morning and then they go and then they run their business. I train them out, they look good. They come here, they're having big bellies, but now they're in shape now, they look good, great.
Castle also organizes white collar tournaments where his trainees can box for real.
They start sparring and they want to know what it feels like to get into a ring with another guy. They like to see what it feels like to fight somebody. Guys that train 2 or 3 times a week now, we're going to get into a ring on a night, put on gloves, and fight somebody they don't know.
But as Katsava says, most people box simply to get and stay fit.
We all enjoy a good party and a good drink, so this is exactly why we come here.
Boxing to burn calories after a heavy night out may not be many people's idea of a good time. But for growing numbers in South Africa, that's exactly what it is. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with athletics. Melaku Belachu smashed the Standard Chartered Hong Kong Marathon race record to win the IAAF Gold Labour Road Race on Sunday. The 27-year-old took more than 2 minutes from his personal best to win in 2 hours, 10 minutes and 31 seconds, improving the race record by 56 seconds. Compatriot Gulume Tolesa made it an Ethiopian double, winning the women's race. On a day of perfect conditions for distance running, the men's race came alive in the final 10 kilometers. It started with a conservative opening 10 kilometers of 41.58 before the pace picked up, with 15 kilometers being reached in 47.03. Belach proved to have the superior finish as he went on to win in 210.31. He crossed the line 3 seconds ahead of Kater as both men finished well inside the previous race record. Takele was third. Further down the field, Mutai, who had been hoping to retain his title by breaking the race record, finished sixth, while Masai dropped out in the closing stages. The women's race played out in similar fashion to the men's, with the contest unfolding only in the closing stages. This time, though, Ethiopian athletes were far more dominant as they filled the top 10 positions. Three Ethiopians battled to the end, with Tolesa getting the victory, while Mekuria finished 4 seconds adrift in second place, with Moges a further 5 seconds back. Meanwhile, in a move aimed at ending the fast-rising change of citizenship cases by athletes, the IAAF Council meeting on Monday froze all new transfers of allegiance in athletics. The move proposed by IAAF President Sebastian Coe was unanimously supported by the Council. However, the decision will not affect the 15 applications for transfer, which are already in progress. Coe said the present rules do not offer the protections necessary to the individual athletes involved and are open to abuse. What is existing now is seen by some as a wholesale market for African talent open to the highest bidder. The move deals a major blow to countries like the USA, Bahrain, Turkey and Qatar, among others, who have a horde of Kenyans competing for them. There are now more than 30 Kenyan-born runners already competing for other nations. Most of these athletes have been lured by oil-rich countries like Turkey, Bahrain and Qatar, while others seek citizenship in the USA. 3 Kenyan-born athletes claimed medals for their adopted countries in Rio. Ruth Jepet won the women's 3,000 steeplechase gold for Bahrain, its first victory at the Olympics, with Eunice Kirwa adding up the tally with silver in marathon a year after winning bronze at the World Championships. Paul Chilemo gave USA silver in 5,000 meters, losing the battle to Somali-born Mo Farah, who is now a Briton. Others are Yasemin Khan, formerly Vivian Jemutai, who competed for Turkey, while Albert Ropp represented Bahrain. Among the high-profile defections include Bernard Lagat, Wilson Kipteker, who is now in Denmark, and Saif Saeed Shaheen, formerly Stephen Cherono, who is in Qatar. The latest Kenyans to change their allegiance to the USA last month are 2012 London Olympics 10,000-meter silver medalist Sally Kipyego and Alfine Taryamuk, who has just won the USA National Cross-Country Championships. And in football, Uganda goalkeeper Dennis Onyango has signed a 4-year contract extension with South Africa's Premier Soccer League champions Mamelodi Sundowns. The 29-year-old played in the Cranes' first 2 matches of the Africa Cup of Nations in Gabon, but missed their last group game because of injury. In January, Onyango was voted the African Best Football of the Year by the Confederation of African Football. He's the only goalkeeper and the first Ugandan to achieve that feat. Finally, and on a sad note, at least 17 people were killed in a stampede at a football stadium in the northern Angolan city of Uige. Hundreds more were reported to have been injured when supporters stormed the gates after failing to gain entry. Some of those who fell became trapped and suffocated at the venue on Friday. Witnesses say the crowd trying to gain access would have taken the stadium past its 8,000 capacity. Santa Rita were hosting Curitiba Dolibolo in a First Division League match. The game ended in a 1-0 defeat for the home side, Santa Rita. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent, the Premier Gao.
Voici les perles, les bijoux. Nobody, 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 n
Baba God Duam, and that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Now, Somalia has a new president in a peaceful transfer of power. Last Wednesday, Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed was chosen as the new president at a meeting room located at the International Airport of Mogadishu, which was heavily protected by UNISOM, the United Nations African Union peacekeeping force, and Somali troops. The reason was that Al-Shabaab, the terrorist group had made a statement that it would disrupt the process. Mr. Mohamed's election was the final stage in a selection process. He was not elected, as we have seen normally in Africa, by people going to the polls to elect their president. Rather, in the case of Somalia, owing to the poor security, it was through an indirect means. It began with a number of Somalis electing clan and sub-clan leaders to become parliamentarians. And these parliamentarians were the ones who met last Wednesday at the Mogadishu airport to select Mr. Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed. It is important to bear in mind that this election was plagued by allegations of corruption, that money was being exchanged for the choice of selecting a new president. In any event, Mr. Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed was the lucky one, and he is now the new president. Everybody has accepted it, and there is a general satisfaction that the entire process has gone out peacefully. Now, there are challenges facing the new president. In the first place, there is great hope that this will be the last time that Somalis will have a president by such a method. The groundwork must be prepared for adult suffrage election in Somalia, because this is the only way that the Somalis can feel attached to the new government. Secondly, the new president has to deal with the issue of corruption, something which is prevalent in many African countries. There are views that the corruption is just too much in Somalia. So that is a major challenge for him. And the third, of course, is poverty that is rampant in Somalia. These are major changes. But Mr. Abdullahi has some experience. He began working in Somalia in the 1980s under the authoritarian rule of President Said Barre, who was ousted in 1991, and following his military ousting, chaos descended on Somalia, and Somalia has not yet recovered from that situation. But at least we now have the semblance of a national government in Somalia. The next challenge is to see whether the new government will try to reach out to resolve this issue with Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab in these last few months have been staging horrific terrorist actions, and the neighbors of Somalia, particularly Kenya, are suffering from this. So the challenge will be what kind of accommodation should be reached with Al-Shabaab to ensure a peaceful Somalia. Thirdly, the international community should make certain that it gives full support to this new government. Already, we have heard words from the African Union and many countries that this may be the last time that UNISOM, the peacekeeping force, will remain in Somalia. So these are difficult changes, but there is goodwill for the new president. And because of his experience, a former prime minister, but lasting for only 8 months, he has worked in the United States, in Buffalo, New York. He is well experienced, and hopefully he will lead the way for all the Somali peoples. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Wojciech Zoniak, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, he who fears the sun will not become chief. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. This is one of a series on the U.S. Constitution and the structure of the U.S. government.
One of the fundamental principles of the United States Constitution, the law of the land, is the balance and separation of power among the three branches of the government: the legislative, or lawmaking branch, that is the U.S. Congress, the executive branch, which is headed by the president, and the judiciary, which interprets the law at every level and settles legal disputes regarding the meaning and the application of the law. The distribution of power among the three branches is meant to ensure that no one branch of the government is able to gain a disproportionate amount of power over the other two. Each branch has separate and unique powers the others cannot impinge upon, but which are nonetheless subject to acceptance or rejection by the other two branches. This is how the balance of power is kept in check. Thus, the Congress writes and enacts laws. It sets budgets and taxes and authorizes borrowing. It is the only body that can declare war. The Congress may override a presidential veto with a 60% vote. Both the House of Representatives and the Senate initiate bills or potential laws. The Senate also ratifies treaties and confirms presidential appointments to federal posts. The House of Representatives creates federal judgeships and courts, except for the Supreme Court, and has the ability to start impeachment proceedings against federal officials, including the president. Once proposed legislation passes through both houses of the Congress, it goes to the president, who either signs the bill into law or vetoes it. In addition, the president is the commander-in-chief of all armed forces, has the power to make treaties and appointments to federal posts, and ensures that federal laws are executed throughout the country. The judicial branch of the government, which includes the Supreme Court and all lower federal courts, decides the meaning of laws, how to apply them to real situations, and whether a law breaks the rules of the Constitution. The accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny, wrote James Madison, the father of the Constitution. The defect must be supplied by so contriving the interior structure of the government, as that its several constituent parts may, by their mutual relations, be the means of keeping each other in their proper places.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.